Some of the earliest mosques in the U.S. were built right here in the Midwest. Today on the 21st, we hear stories about how several religious communities built and grew.
There were only 12 to 15 Muslim families in the greater Springfield area, and today there are over 300.
Plus, fifth grader Shruti Patel plays viola. What makes kids choose to take music classes?
It's kind of easy to play, but not that easy. And I have some of my friends that are violas, so it's fun. It just feels really good.
We'll revisit our conversation with a Northwestern University researcher who asked kids themselves. But first, Illinois has changed its laws regarding child support. They're meant to make payments more equitable for people who've gotten divorced. What does this actually mean to parents and their kids? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. First, this check of the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. Families have changed, marriage has changed, work has changed over the years, but until recently, Illinois laws that deal with divorce and children hadn't changed much in years. At the start of the month, Illinois revamped the way child support is handled. Earlier this year, the state made other changes to the process of deciding who and how to care for kids after divorce. The state is now the 40th to adopt this new kind of model. I'm joined now on the line from Decatur by family attorney Andy Borey. Andy, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
And joining us here from Macomb in Western Illinois, one of the co-sponsors of the bill outlining these new child support guidelines, Representative Noreen Hammond, Republican representing the 93rd District, includes parts of McDonough, Fulton, Mason counties, among others. Representative Hammond, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Representative Hammond, let's start with you. Before we get into the details of the new formula here and the specifics for determining child support payments, what prompted these changes to the way child support obligations are determined for divorcing spouses?
Well, I think this was a long time in the making, certainly, but probably the most important prompt is the fact that there are 39 other states that use this model, and they
have. You kind of wonder what took so long, huh?
Equitable, yeah, right.
So, what? Just an overview here. I mean, what changes now under this under the new law?
So, under this new law. It makes the child support more equitable. There's a more consistent treatment of how the awards are actually done, and I'm sure that Scott can get into some of the details of that.
Yeah, Andy Borey.
Andy, I'm sorry. But basically, it takes into consideration the incomes of both parents, the custodial parent, the non-custodial parent. It takes into consideration the child's or children's needs, their physical care arrangements, whether they have special needs or child care needs. And it calculates according to the adjusted incomes of the two parents. And the time that is spent with each parent is also taken into consideration. So ultimately, we're hoping that not only does it make it more equitable for both of the parents, but also there's less acrimony, if you will, between mm-hmm. the parents.
So more equitable, less acrimony. It sounds like kind of blowing out some of the maybe assumptions that were made for a long time, some of the stereotypes about roles and responsibilities of parents. Andy Borey, I mean, coming to you, obviously this is complex, it's going to depend on the situation, but how do you see this affecting your clients?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is definitely a lot more complex than at first glance. I thought when I first heard of the law and the discussions that people were having when they talked about this law coming into effect, they really talked about basically just taking some numbers off the charts. It's really a lot more than that, I think. And I think that this really will affect clients quite a bit. I think I've done some calculations on the old way that we do things and now the new way that we mm-hmm. do things. And so how does it actually affect my clients? Well, if I've got the person who would be paying child support and they have parenting time meaning overnight with the child or children for less than 146 days, it's actually probably going to be pretty much the same unless they're a really high income earner. I think the high income earners are going to be affected a little bit more because they're not going to be paying quite as high of a percentage since it's not an actual straight percentage now.
And okay, so it used to be based on very specific percentages, and you're saying that those are kind of gone now. It's a little more nuanced.
Yes. It used to be one child was 20%, 20% of net income, and then 28% for two, 32%, and so on. And now there's an actual number, and so how it will work is you take both of the parties' incomes, and you look at both of the parties' incomes added together, and you get that number off a chart, and that chart says that this is how much it takes to raise a child when the parties' incomes are this much. And so when you've got the higher income parties, that percentage has gone down because when they were making the law, they were putting into consideration how much families with certain income levels actually spend on their children. And they found that the higher income, it kind of evens out or levels out at a certain point. And so the people with higher incomes are going to be paying a little bit less of a percentage. But overall, people who have, you know, the maybe middle income families, they're probably going to be paying close to about the same amount. So some people it affects, some people it won't. It will affect people who have over 146 overnights, the parent who has less of the parenting time or a non-majority of the parenting time.
So overnights being if the child stays with you for 146 nights or more over the course of a single year.
Yes.
And then what happens
in
those situations?
That's the point where it will affect it a lot.
And how will, I know we're talking a lot of sort of numbers and things here, so I appreciate sort of people paying it, but these are going to affect people, you know, it just started July 1st, so we're kind of digging into some of the numbers here in terms of how the state deals with child support payments, with parenting responsibilities, some of the acrimony that goes into it. It's not just numbers and formula. We'll talk more about that here in a minute. But if with that 146 number, how does that work? What kicks in if a parent is, if the child is living with that parent for that much time?
There's when you take both of the parties' incomes together and you get that number off the chart, then you look at the share that each parent should have to pay based upon the level of income that they have. And so that's the first part of the formula. Well, if they have over 146 overnights, you get to a different part of the formula. And that different part of the formula uses a multiplier that then helps try to
make it more equitable, I guess. Yeah.
The child support. Yeah, and just trying to make it just more equitable based upon the amount of parenting time that each parent has. So if one parent has, both parents have 50% of the time, well, then the child support will be adjusted to reflect that. And the law was not like that previously. You could get, based upon the previous law, downward deviation on the standard child support percentage, but it was very difficult, and there was no formula to determine how you would do that. Yeah. Now, this new law does actually give you a way to actually make that calculation.
So if your kids are staying with you more than that 146 nights, you're obviously spending a lot more money on them, so it tries to make up for some of that by reducing what would be paid by that parent because they're already putting some of that money in. Representative Hammond, some of the things that we're describing here, you know, the system, and you mentioned before, not just more equitable, but some of the acrimony in the process. We're
Correct.
Looking at, you know, a system that in the past could have seen, and I hate this phrase in this context, but it was almost like a winner-take-all. It was a very oppositional sort of conversation that happened when parents divorced about custody for the children. And this even changes some of the language around that, around child custody and such. But some of those categories, there are a number of categories. Can you talk a little bit about that and sort of how the law changes the way that that formula is calculated and how it's not just one parent making a decision across all these categories, but they're sharing more responsibilities?
They are, and I think that you know, the shared responsibility is perhaps indicative of the age that we're living in, and children certainly have more activities. Both parents are generally working, and so it allows for a little bit more of a leeway, if you will, And I will certainly say that it is not an easy guideline to follow. You certainly need the help of experts in this. But I think at the end of the day, what Illinois was trying to do and model it along with some other states that had seen success in their models was to come up with a formula that was certainly fair for the children and fair for the parents as well. But I think it's also important that we keep in mind this was not done in order to change existing support orders. This was done
good point.
To change how we do things going forward.
So this particular law we're talking about with the child support payments, that comes July 1st and later. So anybody who had that put through a court before July 1st, that still stands?
Correct.
Okay. That's Representative Noreen Hammond, a Republican representing the 93rd District, Western Illinois. Also on the line here, Andy Borey, family attorney practicing out of Borey Law in Decatur. Andy, coming back to you here for a minute. You know, this law determining child support is part of a larger overhaul here, if I can call that, that has been going on in the state. Other changes took effect earlier in this year. You know, under these new laws, divorcing spouses come up with, you know, a parenting plan. You know, it's fairly specific and laid out through the process here. Did that not happen before? What's the idea there?
The parenting plan, when they changed the law from using the terms custody and visitation, the parenting plan, changing those terms to parental responsibilities, they're trying to take away, like you said earlier, that winner-take-all custody issue. And so the decision-making power is now defined in the parenting plan. And there's generally four major areas. You've got medical, education, religion, and extracurricular that we try to split up or determine between the parties who or both are going to make those types of decisions, and the parenting plan defines that. And then you've got the term parenting time, which was formerly visitation, and the parenting plan determines how the parties are going to share time with the children. And it was done before, but I think the change was made in order to try to take away that stereotypical role where we just had one party that was typically had custody of the children, and now it's more of trying to go towards more of an idea that this is a shared type of arrangement for the children, that both parents are going to be involved in making decisions and raising the children. So, I mean, those types of things were happening, and that we were defining how and who the children would spend time with, but I think that they've kind of changed the concept now to try and modernize and kind of catch up with other states with regards to that, because there are a lot of other states that are already share those types of ideas and models.
Yeah. And are you seeing that shift now, Andy, in terms of the clients? This new law, at least, that we're talking about, started July 1st. We're now, you know, almost a month in. Are you seeing this sort of play out, or how are you seeing this play out, I guess I should say, with your clients right now?
I think it's going to be a slow change, but I think that it is helping to understand that both parents can and should be involved in making decisions and raising the children. I've seen a lot more. But before the law changed, you had the typical situation where you were having sole custody for one party, the other party was the non-custodial parent. Now you're getting a lot more joint-type situations because we're talking about decision-making power, and that doesn't necessarily affect the child support, because a lot of the parties do have financial motivators when they're deciding if they're going to do a joint-type situation versus a sole-type situation. Now, I think the decision-making is becoming more equal as to where it wasn't before. I think the points of contention are really going to be the parenting time and whether or not there's going to be over 146 overnights or not. I think that that's where people are going to start to draw their line in the sand. I've seen it already with, I do mediations as well, and I've had one or two mediations since this law went into effect where the parties were not able to come up with an agreement because neither one of them wanted to give up not having 146 overnights. So I think it's the shift, it's starting. I think it's going to take some time to get that mindset away from people. But I think that they're, I think it's good. I think it's a good change here to help kids out.
Well, thank you very much. And Representative Hammond, it just sounds like, you know, we've only got about 15 seconds left here, but it sounds like the idea going in here, and we're starting to maybe see it play out right now, is shifting that focus, you know, off of that battle with winners and losers back to what's best for the children. Is that kind of a summation there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's our focus should be.
Representative Noreen Hammond, Republican representing the 93rd District of Western Illinois, joined us there from Macomb. Also the voice of Andy Borey, Borey Law in Decatur, family attorney with his practice there in Central Illinois. Both of you, thank you very much. I appreciate you kind of pulling back the curtain and helping us understand this new law and what it means for families in Illinois.
Absolutely. Good to visit with you. Thank you.
Coming up next, some of the earliest mosques in the U.S. are nearly a century old, are located right here in the Midwest. We'll learn a bit of that history with a reporter who's written about rural historic mosques. We'll also be joined by a chaplain from the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. You know, more than 80 years ago, a small group of Muslims in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, opened up a mosque called the Muslim Temple, using money they had cobbled together during the Great Depression. It's considered one of the first mosques in North America. It's not the only Islamic community with deep roots in the Midwest. In places like Iowa and North Dakota, early community of Muslims in the 1920s and 30s gathered to try and build a new home for themselves. In fact, the oldest Islamic organization believed to be in the U.S. is in Chicago still. Joining me now to help us learn more about this history is Ryan Schisler. He's a freelance journalist who writes about religion, the environment, and social justice. Ryan, welcome to The 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you know, this history, you know, I guess I would have thought, made some assumptions that larger cities, East Coast cities maybe, might have played a big role in the history of Muslim Americans, but it turns out some of the deepest roots are here in the Midwest. How did this happen?
That's right. Well, the stories of these Muslim communities in the Midwest share the same roots as any immigrant community in this region. They came because land was plentiful and land was cheap, and they were starting new lives for themselves at the beginning of the 20th century.
And I mean, that is largely the story of the growth of America. The group I mentioned in Chicago, I mean, specifically, can you just tell us a little bit about that and the history there and who founded that?
Right. That organization you mentioned was founded in 1906, and it was a benevolent society for Bosnian immigrants from Southeast Europe. They were mostly at first young men who had been contracted to come and help rebuild Chicago after the Great Chicago Fire, but later started families and remained. And that organization acted in its later years as a organization that did funerary arrangements for its members. But it's still around today, and that community has had several mosques in and around Chicago throughout the last century.
And I understand also, so that, I mean, that goes back to the Chicago Fire. That's the late 1800s at that point. You've got primarily men, you said, coming over from Bosnia and from that region. And I understand it also grew, at least in some instances, out of Chicago into other parts of the country.
Right. That organization had chapters in other cities like Gary, Indiana, Pittsburgh, and as far west as Boise, Idaho, and even Los Angeles. But it's also important to note that in Chicago specifically, this organization had some contemporaries, in that in the early 1900s, the early days of conversions of African American families to Islam was beginning, and there's mosques in Chicago that have roots in about that same time as well, especially on the north side.
You know, we briefly mentioned earlier what was called the Moslem Temple. That was in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, now called the Mother Mosque, recognized as the first mosque in North America, you know, built for that purpose. What was that like? How did that come to be? What was it like for the first Muslims in that area to try and build a religious community essentially from scratch?
Well, they came at the end of the 1800s, mostly as peddlers who were going across the prairie, not just in Iowa, but in the Dakotas as well. But they, like any religious group, needed a house of worship eventually. And as their numbers grew in Cedar Rapids, they were able to financially able to build that mosque. And then it also has a contemporary in the town of Ross, North Dakota, along the northwest border of North Dakota and Montana. There was a community of Syrian homesteaders there that built a mosque around the same time, but it wasn't the first purpose-built mosque. There's some records that indicate it was actually a repurposed barn, which is why the Mother Mosque in Cedar Rapids is known as the first purpose-built mosque, and it's still there. The one in North Dakota, sadly, was torn down in the 70s.
Well, and the mosque in Cedar Rapids, too, has had some, you know, some rough moments. Remember the floods several years ago? I think it was 2008. You had written about, you know, but an instance where it is such a fixture in the community that the community really rallied around it when that happened. Can you kind of take us back to that moment in 2008 and what happened and sort of the response from the community?
That's right. I only heard about the flood in 2008 after the fact. I wasn't there covering it when it was going on. But the imam there at the Mother Mosque told me about how once that neighborhood was flooded and the waters had receded, the mosque was severely damaged, though not completely totaled like many of the houses in that neighborhood. But they put out a call for help, and as the imam told me, buses of people of all different religious backgrounds came just because the Mother Mosque is such a fixture in that community and a point of pride for many in Cedar Rapids.
You know, I want to bring someone else into this conversation from Springfield here in Illinois, Maryam Mostofi, chaplain spokesperson with the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much.
You were a part of you know, the first group of Muslim families in the Springfield area. This goes back to around the late 70s, I understand. What can you kind of take us back to that moment? I mean, what was that like? We've heard sort of a national perspective here and kind of the role of the Midwest in general. But right here in Illinois, there are stories to tell, too. What was that like to come and to worship in the early days of your community when there was not an established structure?
Well, when we first arrived, it was 1979 when my family and I moved to Springfield. And at that time, we didn't know any other Muslims. It was a couple years before we actually met other Muslims in the community because there wasn't a central house of worship to where we could go and find other people of our faith. So it was by coincidence that I was introduced to someone who was Muslim, and then from there began to meet other people. And at that time, in 1979, there were, by that time I guess it would be about 1982, there were only 12 to 15 Muslim families in the greater Springfield area, and today there are over 300. And it was in 1985 that we incorporated and became officially the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield. And we purchased our first mosque the year after. And it was a repurposed building that we converted to our own needs. Sadly, in June of 1994, arsonists set it afire and burned it to the ground.
Yeah, and that's definitely something that we would want to hear a little bit more about. I don't know if many people outside of the Springfield area may know that story. You know, just thinking about what you described in the rapid growth of the community there, I mean, how important was it to have that community start to become established for the community to grow in that way? I know you said it wasn't until the mid-80s that there was a formal structure there, but you mentioned going from really not knowing anybody to, you know, having about 15 families and then sort of very quickly growing from there. Once those connections started to be made, was that social and community structure important to the growth there, or was it just sort of coincidence?
It really was, but it was also the growth of the community once we had our own masjid or mosque was a place where people could gather. And it was something that you could identify an Islamic community by. So that when people were interviewing for jobs in the Springfield area, for instance, with the medical school or wherever, one of the first questions they would ask is there a mosque here in Springfield? And because we had great relationships with people in various employment positions, whether it was the medical school or state government or wherever, we could probably say, you know, these people were aware, yes, there is a mosque. So people began to connect, and that was one of the reasons that they were attracted to the Springfield area, was because there was a small and growing mosque. And so that began to build our community.
And what was the relationship there with the greater Springfield area, I guess, in those early days? And then what is it like now? How do those compare?
Well, we had a very good relationship, I think, with the greater Springfield community. I think the individuals that were responsible for the arson, although they've never been caught, I think that was not the norm. I think they were the exception rather than the rule, because we found that within a few hours of it having been made public that our mosque had been burned, five different houses of worship, one synagogue, and four churches offered their places of worship for us.
Wow. So again, that kind of community building. I mean, take us back. Now, you've mentioned the arson now a couple of times. You know, this was 1994, I think you said. This was a difficult time. Can you kind of describe what happened?
Well, it was early in the morning when I was notified that the mosque had been burned. And, of course, we went to the site immediately, and we began to, I personally contacted a man by the name of Larry Golden, who at that time was the chair of our the Coalition to Promote Human Dignity and Diversity, which was a group I was a member of that worked to challenge hate crimes, to build and capitalize on the diversity of our community, and educate other people about the value of diversity. So once I notified him as to what had happened, then he sent out a fax blast to the whole community and all of our membership organizations. And they responded, demanding from law enforcement and the media that this story be covered. You have to understand, this wasn't the only house of worship being burned in the United States that year. That was the same year that we saw a rise in the number of African-American churches that were being burned.
But, I mean, the mosque was clearly targeted, though.
Yes, it was very much targeted, yes. There was no doubt about that.
And how? What was the response then from the community? I mean, you described a little bit there and sort of reaching out and immediately saying we need to make sure that there is media coverage, that people know what's going on here in the community. What happened next?
Well, people began to try to find ways that they could help our community overcome the problems that we were experiencing at the time. In fact, we had the Jewish Federation here in Springfield contacted one of their members, and who was an attorney, and he represented us pro bono so that we could get our insurance claim. We had, like I said, houses of worship that offered their places to us. We had just a tremendous outpouring. Congregations donated money to help rebuild. I, for one, had an opportunity to sit down with then Attorney General Jim Ryan and talk with him about what had happened, and he promised that he would work towards improved reporting and tracking guidelines related to hate crimes. Mm-hmm. And within 6 months, we had much tougher legislation in Illinois that had been passed by both houses.
Wow. So some
that made a big impact, not only on hate crimes that targeted Muslims, but that targeted other minority groups as well.
I mean, it sounds like it's an emotional roller coaster. I mean, to have that an act of hate like that targeting you, your mosque, your community, and then also having this outpouring of support and response and changes in policy and law and in structure, that just sounds like a remarkable moment.
It was. It was an opportunity, though, that we couldn't overlook that. We couldn't just sit and dwell in our own grief at the loss of our mosque. It was an opportunity to do something for the larger community, which, of course, we're a part of.
Yeah.
And that was important because the Muslims within the Springfield community have been very active on social justice issues from the very beginning, and others responded in kind to us. And so it was an opportunity for us to become even more involved in other issues, and we felt an obligation to do that.
And that is the voice of Maryam Mostofi, chaplain and spokesperson of the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield. Also on the line is Ryan Schisler, freelance journalist, writes about religion, environment, and social justice. We're talking about the role of the Midwest in the growth of American Muslim communities, but from North Dakota through Iowa and here right into to Illinois, from Springfield to Chicago. You know, I want to come back for a minute, Ryan, to you. You know, you went and visited some of the mosques you've talked about here fairly recently. What's changed? What are those communities like now?
Well, the biggest change that I've noticed of the ones I've visited is that in Ross, North Dakota, where the number of practicing Muslims is actually probably less than 10, if that. Most people throughout the generations married to Christian families, converted, or moved away. And what's really touching about that story is even though the original mosque is no longer there, there's actually a cemetery there that's still maintained by these families, which includes veterans from World War I and World War II. And these descendants who are no longer Muslims still come back to this place in North Dakota from the other states where they live and clean and maintain this site that's really in the middle of the prairie. It's about an hour drive from the nearest city. These mosques and organizations that I've talked about, they were the first incorporated, but they weren't necessarily the first individuals or families that came to the Midwest. Among the hundreds of estimated Muslims that served in the Union Army during the American Civil War, one named Moses Osman was the highest ranking of them, and he's buried here in Illinois. And he served in the 114th Illinois Infantry, I believe. And then a latter point that I wanted to make is the story of these immigrant groups coming to the Midwest at the turn of the 20th century. It's a story that's still being told today because the same things that attracted those groups then are attracting them now, and that's really affordability of this region. And the story of Muslim immigration to the U.S. continues to have a really prominent role in the Midwest, with examples in St. Louis, which now has the largest population of Bosnians in the country, Minneapolis, that has the largest population of Somalis, and, of course, the Arabs in Detroit and Dearborn. It's an ongoing story, not just a historical one, and it's one that really is a centerpiece of our region for the past century, not longer.
Coming back to you, and unfortunately, we've only got a minute here left, but you know, you have this deep context here from your experience. We've talked a lot today about, you know, the larger history and things, but we're talking at a moment when there's a travel ban on people from some predominantly Muslim countries, when we've seen a jump in hate crimes and harassment around the country. Does this moment feel different to you?
It does. It feels very, very scary. But then I look at the generosity, the kindness of other people outside of the politicians, and it gives me hope. We've had occasions when people early in the morning, before even morning prayers, have come and put post-it notes all over the glass doors and windows at the front of the mosque, and left those notes of hope for us. And that's a beautiful thing. So we can dwell on what some of the politicians may be saying. We can dwell on the travel ban, but that's not going to help. We also have to acknowledge, recognize, and build on the relationships that we've developed and work towards something better in our future.
Yeah, and that's across groups, and that's across, and we, the group again in Chicago, we talked about Bosnian Muslim community. There are many different Muslim communities and other faith groups around the region and certainly around the state who are doing exactly what you just described there. And that was the voice of Maryam Mostofi, chaplain and spokesperson of the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield, also speaking with Ryan Schisler, freelance journalist, writes about religion, the environment, and social justice. Thank you both. I appreciate the time today.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you.
Coming up, what makes kids choose to take music classes? We revisit our conversation with a Northwestern University researcher who asked kids themselves That'll take you inside a music class at an elementary school in Urbana. Stay with us. It's all coming up right after this break.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
This is the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron. Nyla Boodoo is away today. You know, we know already there are all sorts of benefits to playing music as a child. Most kids have to take music classes in school, at least through grade school or so. But after that, when it becomes their choice to take those music classes, most of them quit. There's all sorts of reasons for this, and researchers at Northwestern University looked into this by asking some of the kids themselves. One of our producers visited Leal Elementary School in Urbana also to hear from the kids themselves to find out why some fifth graders there signed up for an elective music class.
Knees slap. Hey, everybody. One, two, ready, go. Shake it on the dance floor.
My name is Agustia Pawate, and I am 10 years old, and I play the viola. I've been playing since, like, September or October. I can't remember, but I've been playing it for a long time, and I've already gotten pretty good at it. I thought that the violin was too high-pitched, and the cello was too low-pitched, so and the viola is right in the middle. So that's why I decided to play it. Miss Gingold, my teacher, she gives me so many new assignments. That's why I think it's so fun, like... And she likes about how I learned all these songs so fast, you know.
Can you do that?
I can do that. Now
she can do it. Beautiful. That's what we need. So, cellos, you have the option of playing the melody part or the slaps.
My name is Luna Morales. I like our teacher, Miss Gingle. She's very nice, and she's really fun, and we have, like, do a lot of fun things. I want to keep trying to play the cello. We can do it as a group and make it sound better. I feel like you can play something really nice now.
Okay, ready, cellos. One, two, ready, D. D slap, A slap, D slap, A slap.
I'm Elisa Thangmanaranke. I'm in fifth grade. I'm 10 years old. I started viola this year, but I've played piano for 5 or 6 years. I like that it's fun, and I like to make music, and it's very pretty. I like recitals and getting to show off. We play in front of my parents and my sisters, and we also get to play in front of people who also take the same lessons as me.
Well, yeah. It's fun because we do it with our friends.
Yeah.
And you get to make more friends.
When you put your bows to the string, use your power finger, right? Captain Fred or Captain Luna or whatever. You're Captain Fred. You're going to push it down. So did you see the stick moving to the hairs? You're going to press it. As opposed to this.
My name's Shruti Patel. I wanted to be in strings since fourth grade. I guess I wanted to play viola because... it was just the thing that I wanted to do. It's kind of easy to play, but not that easy. And I have some of my friends that are violas, so it's fun. It just feels really good.
That's it. That was really, really good. That was really good. Yeah. You got it.
Now, one group of students in the area, fifth grade students, are at Leal Elementary in Urbana who are choosing to continue to take music classes, additional music classes there. Thanks to producer Haula Delahi for that postcard. Steve Demarest is a professor of music education at Northwestern's Beenan School of Music. He worked on the study I mentioned just a moment ago, looking into why some kids keep taking music classes while others don't. He's on the line now from his office. Steve, thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
So it sounds like a fun class. I think they're doing it right there.
It was great.
You know,
it was great. I'm hearing their responses going, yep, that's one of our variables. Nope, that's not. Yep, that's one.
Well, that's what I want. It was like a check. I mean, I heard early on the one student, I think it was Augustia, said, you know, he likes the way that he's been taking it for a long time now. He's been taking it since October or September. You know, another girl a little bit later on said she liked it. She got to kind of show off. You know, is that one of the reasons kids do take classes? Just they feel that they're getting good at it. They feel like this is something that they're special at and that it pushed them to keep going?
Yeah, I mean, what we call sort of positive musical self-concept, what some other researchers call self-efficacy, the belief that you're good or can get better. Absolutely. That was one of our strongest variables in predicting this. And then you heard other kids say, I like it because my friends are in it, and peers, you know, peer influence was another one of the variables.
Interesting. So friends, you know, maybe family members, being yep, around music kind of inspires you to go.
Variable, so yeah.
I'm sorry, I cut you off. What was the strongest?
For the first part of our study, which we were looking at what kinds of things might best predict whether they continue in music, having a family member involved in music of any kind was like the strongest predictor.
Interesting. And that could be a brother, a sister, it could be a parent, just somebody
exactly.
in the household who plays music.
Distinguish. Yeah, anybody. And it could be any kind of music as well. It doesn't have to be, you know, the same music as they're doing in school.
Interesting. Do you have any takeaway from that? Is that just because they're inspired by it? They see it? Is it any?
Well, you know, it's a good question, and we can't really quite dig into that. Like the girl that you had on there who said she plays piano, you know, played piano before she started strings, and that she likes to show off for her family. You know, parents who have their kids take piano lessons are probably likely somebody in the family has had some sort of, you know, musical engagement that mm-hmm. led them to even think that that was a good idea. And so I think it's probably a little bit the culture of the family. Like music is something you can do. It's one of your options,
yeah.
along with soccer and, you know, whatever else, right?
Yeah, the other menu of things that
exactly.
that people can do these days. You know, one thing, there are a lot of assumptions, I think, and I'll only speak for myself because I don't want to, you know, speak generally about anybody else. But, you know, I would think that, so if a kid likes music, if you know, they like to listen to music on the radio or listen to just sort of surrounding themselves by music, that's going to mean they're more likely to want to play music and to continue to choose to play music. That's not what you found.
Well, right. It is a bit complicated that way. So one of the things we measured was sort of their attitude toward music. But another thing we measured was their attitude toward themselves as a musician, what we're calling musical self-concept. And both of those were higher for kids who chose to go on in music, but the attitude toward music was not a significant predictor of their choice. So it sort of, in when you put all the variables together, it kind of fell out as an important predictor.
Interesting.
So it isn't. And this is sort of what we had said earlier, you know, and sort of our rationale for doing this study is that students may opt out not because they lack interest, but because they lack, you know, that there's some self-perceived inadequacy.
How do you mean?
Musician.
That they're not very good?
They like it, but they think they're not talented. For example, talent is a word that's, as to me as a music educator, I'm becoming more and more
cringing at?
I'm becoming more and more disenchanted with that word, and unfortunately we music teachers use it a lot, but I think that it suggests, you know, talent versus skill or whatever sort of suggests it's something you possess or don't possess rather than something you can develop or not develop. And I think it's really, really, really about what you can develop.
And it's interesting, that's what stood out so much, that it's sort of that the idea of that self-concept. When do kids start to develop that concept?
Yeah, that is a great question. So we measured in this district, elementary school went through sixth grade before they switched, even before they went to elective music. So clearly our sixth graders had a pretty strong formation. This is one of the studies we're planning right now.
Hmm.
We want to look at kids as much as we can, like even back to first grade. It's a little bit trickier to ask them questions, you know, but we want to go all the way back and see, you know, at what point do they start to sort of compare themselves to other kids, and at what point do they, you know, what kind of attributions do they make? Like, I think with young children, for example, other studies have shown they're more likely to believe that they can get better at something
mm-hmm.
when they're younger, and as they get older, they start to think that their abilities are a little bit more fixed, what's called attributions of success or failure. So I really want to look at the attributions as it crosses over with this musical self-concept. You know, at what point does a child perhaps develop an idea that they have a certain amount of this fixed quality called talent that's either going to keep them from getting better or not? Because as soon as you think that, as soon as you think you know you can only get so good, that's when you start to make decisions.
Locked into something.
Yep.
You know, so in just one, Hala, who produced that story, did just chat into the chat room here that all the students that were on, that we heard in that did have a family member who played music. So just one more interesting little tidbit. I didn't realize that before. But, you know, just very briefly, because I know we're focused primarily on sort of what you've learned from this study and whatnot, but just as somebody who is so immersed in music, can you remind, you know, people just what is the value of playing music, of being exposed to music at a young age?
Well, you know, there's all sorts of things out there about music makes you smarter, music makes you better at language, music makes you this, music makes you that. And I mean, I don't know how true some of that is. There's definitely been questions raised about those connections. I do think that our brains are very interconnected. And so certainly being able to develop, for instance, the capacity for fine grain pitch perception or fine motor perception is probably going to benefit you in more than just the thing you're doing. Right. Mm-hmm. Somebody here at Northwestern, Nina Krause, does a lot of work with, you know, with sort of looking at young children's music study and how that might affect, for instance, their ability to process certain linguistic information. For me, as a music teacher, as a musician, it's really more about the opportunity to develop yourself, your sense of your sense of self, your expression. There are researchers looking at things like it feels good to synchronize with other people.
Hmm.
So like young children who are involved in musical activities maybe express a little different level of empathy and things like that. But it's not about empathy per se, but about being connected to a group of people.
Yeah, and understanding in a different way as opposed to sitting there and doing whatever goes on the rest of the day in a class, you there is a different connection there. You are joining in literally and figuratively harmonizing with other people to create something new.
Exactly. And that harmony is both pitch and rhythm. That is, you're also in synchrony as well as in harmony. And that seems to be sort of powerful for people's sense of connection and people's sense of belonging. And I think that, you know, I think there's more work to be done in that area. And that's one of the things that we're interested in looking at as well. But what I really want is for kids who are interested in doing this to not sort of self-select out because somebody else gave them the idea they're not good, mm-hmm. that they can't get better. For me as an educator, it's really about kids having choices. I don't think that music I'm a choir director, so I'm more interesting, but you know, I don't think choir is necessarily everybody's jam, right? That's okay. But I don't want kids to not do it because they think they're not good enough or because they think they can't get better. So that's, for me, it's more about I would like to see young children's choices and sense that they have choices maintained as long as possible. I think that's really vital to a good education.
And, you know, I mean, one thing that comes to mind, you talk about choir. That's something that anybody can do. Other things, you know, we heard a viola player, you know, other people play instruments. That can be expensive. You know, they have to get the instruments, you know, whether you rent them or whatnot. And, I mean, there are other obstacles that confront people when they want to, even if they really do want to continue playing with music. Are there tools? Are there, you know, have you seen any of that crop up and see any sort of advice for folks in that area?
Yeah, well, there from a research standpoint, when you look at studies that talk about kids choosing to participate in instrumental music, all of a sudden things like socioeconomic status pop up more than they do in vocal music for this very reason, the cost of participating. On the other hand, you also get that once parents make the investment, they maybe push a little harder to have their kids stay in it, right? There's not a cost to dropping out of choir.
Mm-hmm.
You still get to keep your voice. But, you know, if they bought a trumpet or paid for all these lessons, they're like, oh, you should keep this going a little while longer because we've invested a lot.
You made an investment, yeah.
I think that it's one of those things, again, where there are certainly challenges, but I think most responsible instrumental music teachers and responsible schools will bend over backwards to provide a kid with what they need. If they really want to do this, there are school instruments in a lot of schools. I'm not as familiar in the Chicago area, but I lived in Seattle for a number of years, and there were several organizations where people donated their instruments. So there was this sort of instrument bank where kids could come and check them out, you know, and use them. And so I think that those things are actually surmountable. but people don't think that they are.
Yeah,
right?
Or maybe aren't aware of. Yeah, maybe aren't aware of some of the.
Exactly.
The
first thing you get is like the sheet of paper saying, "Okay, here's where you can go to rent your instrument," and you go, "Oh crap, I can't afford to rent an instrument." But it's important to just be able to, you know, go and talk to the teacher and not feel bad, because I mean it is expensive, and you know, the biggest thing is you know, figuring out a way, and I think the teacher will work with you, figuring out a way to get that kid in there if that's what they want to do.
Well, so this we're talking about.
That should not be a barrier, I would hope.
Yeah, or find a way over it. Well, this is one survey, a little over 300 sixth graders from 5 elementary schools, but it sounds like there's a lot more still to learn. Steve Demarest, Northwestern University, will get a tweet out some more information about this study at 21st Show on Twitter. And thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
That's all the time we have here today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for the 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us by phone, email, social media, that's all at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Scott Cameron. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.